You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko meri makare ta toku ingoa nau mai haere mai ki te wā mō tēnei rā. Kia ora everyone. Welcome back to another Wire with me running around like a headless chicken because I'm so stressed. It's Rāpare, June 18th. You're on 95BFM and I'll be taking you through the next hour. A lot of New Zealand politics today. FRKNA on the show today, and today's catch up with Minister Little. I ask about reaching a redress deed with Ngā Iwi o Taranaki and why changes this government say need to happen have not happened over the last term. Unfortunately, I could only talk to Andrew for about 5 minutes this morning. He was running off to a meeting, so I didn't get to hear everything or ask everything that I wanted to. But we are also talking all about the fast-tracking consents for 11 projects at the moment, and all of those interviews with Rod Oram, Generation Zero and Sata Whātu come back to that idea of whether or not this government is inconsistent in their messaging and policy reflection. We hear Tracy Martin's comments on Elder Abuse Awareness Day. And finally, we hear from Zoe Kanatis for Neighbourhood Watch. She tells me about the problem of branch stacking in Australian politics and Scott Morrison's comments about slavery and history. Tuku pātuhi mai, text me on 5395 or YMI, give us a call on 309-3879. I just messed up all those phone numbers, but I think I got there in the end. And you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website as per. But let's get into it.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, it is indeed time to hear from Andrew Little again. Just to reiterate, unfortunately, I could only hear from him for 5 minutes this morning. So a lot less is covered than needs to be, but we'll be revisiting that later on in the show with Rod Oram, Te Ara Whātu and Generation Zero. So do stay tuned and let's hear what Andrew had to tell me about Ngā Iwi o Taranaki. Let's touch on the fact that the negotiations between the Crown and Ngā Iwi o Taranaki are coming to a close soon.
Sure.
What's the process over the last couple of years been like, and what can we expect from the collective redress deed?
Look, it's been a good process. Obviously, there's 8 iwi involved, and they all have a very important stake in the maunga. And their thing is they want to make sure that their voice in terms of the governance over the maunga and its conservation strategies and utilisation of the national park is a real one and an effective voice and a genuine part of the decision making. So we've worked out some good structures about that. The maunga remains as a national park, but the governance arrangements will be different to some of the other national parks, and working in with the local conservation authority. So there's that. There's the remaining issues are some of the funding issues. What do we need to do to make sure that the iwi voice is strong and resourced and supported to be effective around the decision-making table? So this is the last issue that we're dealing with. And I think once we get the final deed sorted out and the final details done, then you know, you'll see that there's a range of issues there, largely about how they have, or their voice has input in to the decisions and the resources that go with that, and their ability to make sure that, you know, the conservation values are their values as much as, you know, those expressed under the National Parks Act.
Mm. It's comforting to hear that the sort of ongoing input of governance behind the National Park, as you touched on, will be upheld. Obviously, when I'm researching for this interview, this news was still talked about as terms of a settlement. And we know now that the ongoing impact of colonialism means that these issues aren't ones that will ever have full and final settlement. Do you think that we should still even be using the term settlement when talking about relations between the Crown and upholding Te Tiriti o Waitangi?
It's not a term I use, or at least I try to avoid using it, and only because actually a lot of iwi I've engaged with, and especially Ngāpuhi, who don't like the term, their characterisation of it to me is a settlement sounds like the conclusion of something, whereas for Iwi and Māori, they see this as the beginning of something. They see it as a restoration of something that that should never have been lost in the first place. And I think that's right. And in terms of Pākehā and the Crown, it's restoring a relationship to the way that it should have been, with a sense of equality, but actually a sense of empowerment of Iwi to start taking back control of their destiny, Tino Rangatiratanga and Mana Matuhake. So I, when I'm talking about the agreement that's reached, I talk about agreement on redress, because that's what it is. But the way I approach it is, this is about putting back together a relationship that has been severed or severely damaged because of the Crown's actions in the past, because I want people to have a sense that we are building something again, or rebuilding something and strengthening a relationship that's one of mutual respect. And that is not what a settlement is. It is, and so we have to characterise it differently.
Mm. You yourself have said this week on that note about restoration and moving forward and improving the relationship from here on means that change needs to come from all of government. This was in the context of speaking at the Black Lives Matter march and acknowledging problems in the configuration and operation of our justice system. Mm. How differently do you think your government would approach the implementation of these beliefs into policy reform if elected again, or if elected without New Zealand First?
Yeah, I think, look, there's a real willingness. And actually, with New Zealand First, they, I look at the reality is they take a more conservative view on these things, but they're not, absolutely and utterly opposed to a more progressive approach to criminal justice reform. In fact, they say, they perfectly well articulate the major problems we've got, this massive over-representation of Māori in the system, and a system that is, we're just locking a whole bunch of people up, and nothing significantly happening as a consequence. We're not helping people. We're not addressing for individuals the things that have driven them into criminal offending. So they get all that, but with any Conservative Party, there's that natural hesitation about getting too far ahead of the electorate. My view is, you see a problem, you've got to call it out. And actually, leadership is sometimes about getting ahead of the pack. That's what leadership is. And that's just a healthy tension that we have. But I think, look, from Labor's point of view, we do know this is a major problem. We've got a very active Māori caucus who, give me a lot of support in the space. And I hope after the election, if we're in a position to continue change, and with the benefit of a strong Māori caucus, we can continue to make real progress. I think we've done very well in getting the debate underway. Kelvin Davis has done a good job in terms of corrections and starting to change some of their culture. But we know we're near where we need to be in terms of a justice system and a criminal justice system that better deals with people to stop offending. And ultimately, in terms of community safety, reducing the numbers of victims of crime in the future, and that's what the objective has to be.
So that means that if elected again, we can expect to see in the next term more implementation of robust and actual change, say, for example, recommendations made by Moana Jackson on the criminal justice system.
Yeah, well, we had a lot of recommendations coming out of the Māori Summit, criminal justice summit that we had as part of the Hapaitia program of work, and that is still continuing too. And there's some initiatives that the Māori Summit came up with in terms of structure and places in the decision-making forums. But actually, just, whereas at the moment we've got within the justice sector all the different departments, police, the Ministry of Justice, corrections and various others, all with their own kind of Māori advisory groups, none of that's joined up. And so we don't get a sensible conversation about the system as a whole. And they have said, look, what's the point of splitting all this up into different sort of categories just based on, how we budget things? This is a system that people move through, and if we want to do the best, we've got to have a more cohesive and coherent approach to it, and the Māori voice has to be heard in that. They talk of it a mana orite model, an equality model, which I'm attracted to, and we're sort of working out what that means in practice. So I would certainly hope that we can continue that work and implement that sort of thing.
Cool. Well, we eagerly await some implementation of that.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
That was indeed Andrew Little. Now we're going to hear from another minister in the government. Yesterday, Lillian Hanley spoke to New Zealand's First Tracy Martin. If you tuned into the Wednesday Wire, you will have heard that interview. What they ran out of time to play yesterday was a story about Elder Abuse Awareness Day. As the Minister for Seniors, Tracy has called for New Zealanders to have zero tolerance for elder abuse as part of World Elder Abuse Day. This was on Monday of this week. Lillian asked her about elder abuse and the effect of COVID-19 on New Zealand's senior population. Here's Tracy.
So what we're running again this year is just trying to raise the profile of this issue. It's another situation that we have in this country. You know, we've got this underlying sort of level of abuse, whether it be family violence, sexual violence, child abuse or elder abuse. It's one of those things that we keep acknowledging the figures, but we don't seem to be able to shift the dial. So, again, one of the things that the government's doing is trying to make sure, raise the profile of elder abuse during this particular week. And also we've funded during COVID, we were very worried about more of our seniors becoming vulnerable in that space. So we actually funded some more support services through Aged Concern and other organisations like that.
Mm. What did we see through that COVID lockdown period of this sort of abuse or other concerns for elderly?
Well, there's a couple of things that we saw. First of all, that first week of lockdown, my office and I had to talk quite strongly, I suppose, to the Ministry of Health about the language they were using with regard to our 70-pluses. They kept referring them to our most vulnerable. Now, many of our 70-plus citizens are actually really vibrant. You know, they're still out there. They're playing sports. They're working. They're, you know, cycling. They're very active. They didn't feel vulnerable. They also kept referring to them as elderly. Now, I don't know, you may not be there yet, but there's a time in your life when you hear the word elderly, you instantly think it's somebody 20 years older than you.
Right.
So that the words didn't resonate. It started to really annoy that demographic. And also, I needed to remind them that just because these people were over the age of 70, they didn't lose their human rights, which meant that they were able to go out and have a walk. They were able to do exercise in the same way that anybody, you know, younger was able to do it. But that we needed to obviously put in systems and support them for them to be fully informed about how to keep themselves safe, because their particular demographic, while they're not overarchingly vulnerable, they are vulnerable to COVID. And did we know that they had people who could do their shopping for them? Did we know they could get their medication? So, you know, after that first week of lockdown, we started calling around. The first 150,000 70-pluses that we knew didn't have an email address, for example.
Right,
And we found about 3,000 people who had nobody to help them. So, you know, that's a substantial number of people.
That is a substantial number, and that's kind of what I most want to focus on around this. Just lastly, in terms of, and I guess when you talk about elder abuse, my understanding is that, you know, whether it be family members taking advantage and that sort of thing. But there's also the element, and like you say, there's 3,000 people who may be just completely on their own. So in terms of isolation and loneliness and possible depression, what is the government doing about that for our Komatu, I might say, rather than elderly?
Yeah, well, and actually it's interesting. It's another one of those situations where the government needs to resource and devolve down to community. And so what we saw during COVID, we saw it brilliantly. It was brilliantly demonstrated that community stepped up for each other. Let's just talk about the student army and what the student army did very quickly, which shifted into this shop and drop situation across New Zealand. But then you had the Lions and the Rotary guys up at Maharangi, for example. I think they were called the Maharangi Marauders, that if a senior or a disabled person drove up to the supermarket in Warkworth and parked in a certain place on a Tuesday and Thursday, they could hand their shopping list to somebody who'd go in and shop for it, and then all they needed to do was get out of the car, pay for it and go home. So we saw community step up. This is the conversation that Portal Williams, as the Minister for Community and Voluntary Sector, and I are having about, for our seniors, how can we fund community much more sustainably for them to be able to, and what the student army wants to do is go from shop and drop to shop and chat. So actually still have a student going and doing the shopping for a senior person, but then taking it in, putting it away and having a cup of tea. So you know, there's still movement and things that we can pick up from COVID, but it is going to take us to change the way we fund so that we front end that spend.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Lillian Hanley and Tracy Martin. Someone has texted in. They say, a treaty is not something you settle. A treaty is something you live and obey. There is no such thing as a treaty settlement. We can only settle a treaty by rewriting another one. The term treaty settlement is a term created by the Crown to allow them to hold on to land taken from Māori without needing to rewrite the consultation. Sorry, the Constitution. Okay, everyone can see how bad my eyesight is because I could barely read that text. But thank you very much for your text. I encourage you to stay tuned when we talk to both Generation Zero and Te Ara Whātū. We touch on this exact concept. We'll be back after these messages.
Can you imagine the world before coffee?
I'll tell you what, I'm two coffees deep right now and I'm still having trouble imagining the world. There's just so many bits in it. You know, it's just hard to keep it all in your head.
Maybe you have another coffee and try again.
Imagine Auckland before coffee. Thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters, you don't have to. Auckland's original coffee roasters and your local since 1992. Swing by their Kingsland-based cafe and roastery or shop online at atomiccoffee.co.nz.
Being in the dark about your KiwiSaver is no big deal, right? It's just money. A few dollars. A few $100,000. Who needs to retire? On the other hand, you could talk to Kōra Wealth. Their 100% Kiwi-owned and operated KiwiSaver scheme is personalised for you, so you get the retirement you deserve. Ethical investments and some of the lowest fees in the industry. Shine a light on your future with Kōra Wealth. Visit kourawealth.co.nz today. That's K-O-U-R-A wealth.co.nz.
Oh, yo, this beat slaps.
It rips hard, eh?
Yeah, totally. Check out the flip. Link in bio.
Killing it. F's in chat, fam.
Link in bio, fam. Sound up. Click right here for more Metro Boomin, X Mike Will, X Offset, X Quavo type beat.
Three fire emoji.
Remix of the day is rounding out your morning glory with one chopped, not slot, banger. Weekdays before midday on 95BFM. Thanks to Lord of the Fries, saving the world bite by bite.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. One of the Mosley guards is just texting and asking for a shout out. Shout out always to my Devo rats. This week, the government announced which 11 projects will be fast-tracked through the consent process. The justification for rushing builds for these infrastructures has been the necessity to find a stimulus for the current recession. Now, I wanted to learn about the importance of stimulus for economic recovery. Of course, everything in politics is a balance, and no one's negating the necessity of economic recovery, but do these fast-track consents act as effective stimulus? I asked Rod Oramall about this and what ventures act most effectively as economic stimulus historically and in his opinion. I learnt about stimulus and as helping to recover economic downturn in an Economics 101 paper a couple of years ago. So I was wondering if we could have a little bit of a refresh together about what the theory behind that is.
Yes, absolutely. Well, my view is very straightforward. That's a very poor excuse for doing this. Because it's going to create only an estimated 1,250 or so jobs, which is a very, very minor stimulus, if any, compared with the greater picture of stimulus that's flowing into the economy in various ways. Mm. And so the idea that this is economically valuable to have these particular projects go that much faster, I just don't think stands up to scrutiny.
What kind of other ventures do we historically take on for stimulus, and should we be looking at considerably different options now, given that we're in this sort of new landscape?
The stimulus can obviously come in all kinds of forms, and we're seeing some new forms this time around in terms of the very direct cash stimulus to households and to companies with wage subsidy and other support. So that's completely unprecedented. And that makes great sense because that puts the money exactly where it's needed. The idea, though, that somehow doing lots of infrastructure is a great stimulus, I think is a far more marginal construct because there was already a fair amount of construction going on, which has now resumed. Mm. And one of the questions hanging over, could we do more infrastructure, is just who would be doing those jobs. that then begs the question is, we're getting people unemployed from other sectors who could be retrained, but that's all a process that takes time, which then argues against the question that this is a stimulus, or the incitement that now this is stimulus we got to use now.
Right. Wow, that's really interesting. And so obviously it is always a balance. I wanted to ask about whether or not this is a failure to balance the importance of both the necessity of a stimulus, but also keeping intact processes that involve public consultation within the RMA. So there is speculation that possibly this is a utilisation of COVID-19 as an opportunity to get those 11 major projects through. What do you sort of make of that criticism?
First of all, the 11 projects themselves are worthy, and some of them have been around a really, really long time. So the cycle path from West Haven in Auckland to Akaranga on the North Shore is the Sky Path, which has been mooted, planned, debated for years.
Yeah.
And now apparently it's suddenly going to happen. Similarly, the electrification of the line from railway line from Papakura to Pukekohe, that's a good thing to do. And construct three rail platforms, particularly at Drury, where there's a lot of house building going on. That's a good thing to do too, but it's not clear why speed is of the essence, which seems to be the driving rationale for all this. These are things that have been long in the many of these have been long planned and will be built, and therefore suddenly doing them at speed with this very substantial change in process doesn't feel at all valid to me. Furthermore, if there were legitimately projects that should be done at speed for reason that there's a failed piece of infrastructure that needs to be replaced very rapidly, I'm thinking of the terrible sewage problems that Wellington's got, for example. And then there are other mechanisms. So, for example, the Environmental Defence Society very helpfully suggested or recommended that if there is going to be fast track, then it would still be possible for interested parties to send a written submission to the panel judging that fast track process. And so they at least have that evidence in front of them. So it's not as good as having people then coming to give evidence, but at least it is giving a way for those voices to be heard and for the panel to take that into consideration too. And I don't think that a very straightforward mechanism like that would slow up the decision-making process, you know, other than by a day or two, whilst the panel considered those particular written submissions.
The question that still lies is, why can't the existing system be used to produce robust consent without the need to take the process out of the hands of council, or without specifically preventing public input? How worried should we be about these concerns?
I still believe that when we get, hopefully in the next term of Parliament, some very substantial change to our regulatory system on these issues. And here I'm very much a fan not of constantly tweaking the RMA, but actually stepping back and having a real first principles look at it, which is exactly what the Environmental Defence Society, along with the Property Council and some other business organisations alongside EDS, have done in their ongoing RMA reform project, which is full of terrific insight and tremendous recommendations. So I'm still confident that as we go through that process, the ability for the public at large and, of course, interested parties in particular to have a say in this will be maintained. And if there's the faintest suggestion otherwise, we should all fight very strongly to make sure that that principle is upheld. So I am confident about that longer-term process, which is why I think this fast track now is a bit daft, really. It's a process for a handful of projects for 1,250 jobs that on projects that were going to be built anyway. Some that have been hanging around a long time. A lot of effort's gone into this, and it's hard to see what the value of doing so is.
Mm. How much do we need to utilise opportunities for other stimulus over the next couple of months? How much do we know the government has in store for, like you say, things that aren't just concerned with infrastructure?
Very much the case, and that gets a little harder to work out what those new kinds of stimulus need to be. But for example, if we first of all stick just with infrastructure, there needs to be a far stronger lens on all these investments as what's future-proofing the country, right, and particularly from a climate change mitigation point of view and adaptation point of view. Adapting to rising sea levels and mitigation, reducing emissions. We are very weak on that in New Zealand. Some countries are tracking better on that than we are. The EU, for example, is proposing a €750 billion program. Still has to be agreed and signed off by all the member parliaments to have that kind of green recovery focus, and some other countries are doing better than others on that, but we are really weak on that. Mm. In announcing these 11, the government is saying, "Oh, look, well, there's two cycleways in there, so that's good. That's part of all that electrifying rail. That's part of all that." And it is, well, yes, it is, this is really messing around on the edges, on the outer fringe of the issues we need to be dealing with.
Yeah. Well, time will only tell if we're going to have a principles-based RMA and also incorporate provisions against climate change more effectively, hey?
Yes, that's the big thing to push for, because the RMA is a fine piece of legislation in many ways. The very big sort of reform that this working group has been looking at over recent years and working very hard still retains a lot of the essential principles of the RMA. It's not throwing the whole thing out and starting all over again, but it's making it now more than 30 years after it was first introduced, making that legislation really, really appropriate for the sort of issues we face today, and also needing to deal with confidence and clarity with all these pressing issues. So the time frame on all these things is getting far more compressed compared with where we were 30 years ago. And crucially, the interdependence of issues. So, for example, how so many factors create additional push on climate change, and then when that climate change happens, it has far more knock-on effects. So there's this great interdependence of issues that we've been very poor with dealing with in the past, and we need to get really good at doing.
Every time in terms of this government recognising that these, I'm talking more generally now, but they recognise all of these problems and tell us that they hear us and believe us and see these to be issues. But the reform over the last term doesn't necessarily reflect any inclination to change it, which is funny when you think about the let's do this rhetoric of before this term started. To finish, do you want to tell us a bit about how much you think this is another example of that, or how if that concerns you that this government has sort of fallen into that pattern of behaviour a lot?
Yes, I think that's exactly an accurate and appropriate description of what's going on here. And these things are always complicated, but I think there are two very pertinent factors. The first one is there are a number of ministers who don't have prior government experience, and that's not unusual. It's not a disqualification from office, but it does require a strong collegial effort to make the most of the talent you've got and to develop the talent you've got. And some ministers are doing fine, others not. But I think the far more important one is the very corrosive effect that New Zealand First has on the coalition, because you have very talented young ministers such as Julianne Genta in transport, the Associate Minister of Transport. So she came up doing a lot of work with officials and industry and everybody else on a very comprehensive policy program to get us into low emission and electric vehicles over coming decades. And New Zealand finally having a fuel efficiency standard on our vehicles. We're the only OECD country that does it by 2025. So that's hardly groundbreaking, but we don't have that. But New Zealand First killed that, and on completely, completely false grounds, that the fee rebate system that would incentivize that would be an undue burden to people in rural communities. That's not the case. The fee rebate scheme would benefit people of lower incomes, and all the data was in the policy documents, if anybody cared to read it, about how lower income people and the sort of cars they bought would benefit the most. And so complete nonsense. And so at every turn, New Zealand First, Winston Peters' attitude is the government, you know, the Labour Party should thank us because we've made it possible for them to be in power. And that's technically correct. There's a few votes that put them over the top. But a party which is only polling about 2 or 3% currently should not have such an enormous veto power over the party that represents 10 times or 15 times that part of the population. And every time Shane Jones and Winston Peters say ridiculous things which absolutely do not align with the facts at all, and they're doing it only for their personal political ambitions to cling on to power, every time they do that, that must be amazingly discouraging to those ministers in the government that are actually trying to do things. So I think Peters and Jones in particular, there are actually some good people in New Zealand First, but Jones and Peters in particular, and they are the leader and the deputy leader after all, are astonishingly corrosive. Mm. And I would hope that when we get to the election in September, people will have a good think about that.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was Rod Oram. Notice when we were talking about the Resource Management Act, Rod referred to it as a fine piece of legislation, which is interesting because we're now hearing from representative from Te Ara Whātū, an organisation that fights for climate justice, an issue that they say impacts Indigenous populations considerably. I asked India Logan Riley about their perception of the RMA and why the fast-tracked process exacerbates breaches of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. The RMA is, one could argue, itself a colonial presence. Do you want to touch on what your organisation's impression of the decision to fast track these process was, to and the extent to which you feel it breaches Te Tiriti, and whether or not that was already happening under the RMA, and how worried you are that this is an acceleration of that issue?
The RMA itself does not reflect or accurately uphold Te Tiriti or Waitangi. Mm. In fact, the principles that it references in and of itself is not Te Tiriti itself. The principles were kind of government-fashioned ideas that they pulled out of Te Tiriti, but it isn't Te Tiriti itself.
Mm.
So, yeah, many of us have been keeping an eye on the RMA and this fast-track process, and we're really concerned because we're seeing a step away from upholding Te Tiriti rather than moving towards it.
Mm.
And in a legislative structure where the breaches of Te Tiriti were already locked in by government law, it's definitely a backward step. And even though they're looking at ending the amendment in 2 years' time, in a space when there's going to be a lot of money going into new infrastructure and new projects, it's very concerning that they're willing to kind of overlook Te Tiriti all over again.
Yeah, particularly because, and look, I've been having this conversation with so many different people this morning, especially because of Andrew Little's comments at the Black Lives Matter march on Monday, when he said change needs to come from all of government. Of course, many Māori advocates have been saying, well, if it needs to come from all of government, why haven't any of those changes started under your government? Does it seem to your organisation, Te Arawhātu, that these colonial measures will be accelerated?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing here is an outcome of successive governments being completely unwilling to face the racism that's embedded in their legislation.
Mm.
And we're seeing that repeated all over again with this particular government. Is just, we can see it's there, but we're not going to do anything about it. And we saw that with the last Labor government as well, some extreme breaches of Indigenous rights principles, ones where the UN actually started to look very seriously at what the previous Labor government was doing, and I think this particular government is continuing that legacy by rushing through this fast-track process, by its refusal to do anything about, you know, the theft of Māori children by the state, the whole conflict around Ihu Mātou, and refusing to step in and be a leader in that space. It's really weak of them, and it really disappointing because we hear their words but we don't actually see any follow through.
What does this mean for the patterns of advocacy for your group? Where do you envision this movement might go next?
Yeah, well, I think I definitely want to acknowledge that racism in Aotearoa was born hundreds of years ago, and it's been something that Māori have been resisting for generations and generations, and we will continue to do that work because we have to. We have, you know, like a kaitiaki responsibility to demand better for our communities and for local communities. So I think it's a continuation of the work, and it's I think it's really important to acknowledge the ways in which racism is being pushed back on around the world, and in the context of that, to see the government creating a fast-track process in the IMA that accelerates or enables further racism and harm of Māori communities and harm of local communities is really appalling, and it's really sensitive to the changes that are being asked of us, to the changes that are being asked of colonial governments to make. Yeah.
An OIA request to David Parker's office has shown that efforts that treat Māori as a lobby group did not deliver on Māori consultation for this bill as promised. Do you know about the nitty-gritty of what that inclusion looks like and where the failure was?
Yeah, so I know that they consulted with the iwi chair's leader group, and what they've basically come up with, or what David Parker's office has come up with, is that the proposed projects will go to an expert group, and the expert group is mandated to have iwi representation, but in nowhere is it embedded that it needs to be co-governed or it needs to have local iwi representation and that kind of thing. And the expert group can invite stakeholders to give advice on the projects, but what it really misses is that so much of our Indigenous knowledge, so much of our Māori knowledge when it comes to our local environment is held by the local community. And so that expert group may not necessarily be able to understand the full dynamics of what's happening when they're looking at a project,
yeah.
You know, how it's going to impact on the ground, environmentally, how it's going to impact trying to address climate change. And we saw this happen actually last year with the cycleway in Kaikoura, where they started building it, and the local iwi were like, you shouldn't be doing this. It's building on our wahitapu, it's building on our urupa, it's building on our wahitonga. And they ended up actually having to stop the project partway through because they hadn't even bothered to listen in the first place to those concerns or make space for those concerns. And that kind of thing can be addressed and prevented very easily through a co-governance model.
Mm.
And what they're doing is they're fast-tracking projects that actually do, will have, what they're doing is they're fast-tracking projects that contain more possibility to do harm than good because they're embedding these paternalistic colonial structures.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yeah.
That was India Logan Riley. Grizzy texted in saying, a freaking men to that Rod about what Rod Oram said about New Zealand First. Thanks for texting in, Grizzy. It's nice to hear from you again. It's interesting hearing that against what India was just saying about colonial legacies among all of these governments. Definitely some food for thought there. Now, in the final installment of this package about the fast track consents, I spoke to Generation Zero about this possibly being a missed opportunity to implement climate obligations that this government already committed to. Let's hear more.
Generation Zero's position is that having public participation is always a good thing, and it's something that we always encourage because building a consensus around projects that specifically are going to be in people's backyards, mm. You know, making sure that local people do have a bit of a say in, you know, what is actually going to be happening around them is super important. Not only to make sure it's a robust decision-making process, but also to give opportunity for people to say, hey, this is something that you could change to this project that would like mitigate the adverse effects on me and my community, and there is no opportunity for that to come through.
Mm. How much does Generation Zero care about the specificity of each project, and will you guys partake in advocacy to prevent those projects going forward, or is that not precisely what the concern is here?
I think you're right, and in that there are certain projects that we definitely do have concerns about. We do look at the list and we think most of them are really good. There are cycleways in there, walkways, electrification of rail, a lot of papakāinga development, and we would support those projects. There is a roading project in there, the Papakārita Turi improvement,
mm.
And, you know, I guess it's not building a new road, which is good, but also not exactly something that we would necessarily advocate for being
for sure.
on the list.
For sure.
And I think there has been a lot of concern around the water storage reservoir. Just, I think, because there are so many adverse effects and there's no process to, you know, make sure that those adverse effects are mitigated apart from an expert consenting panel.
Mm.
And we're not entirely sure that those adverse effects can be mitigated.
Mm.
You know, it is an absolute missed opportunity that a climate assessment wasn't made of this piece of legislation.
Mm.
I think last year the government did make a commitment that all legislation would have a climate impact assessment on it, and the fact that this one doesn't is quite disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. A key concern out of this is that by compromising the ability of the public to have input is another breach of te tiriti o waitangi. And I found it interesting from the get-go that the term non-controversial was used about shovel-ready projects. What do you make of the semiotics of the idea of some projects being non-controversial, particularly in the context of occupation of land in Aotearoa being a breach of te tiriti when it's not done with iwi consent?
Yeah, and I think, so Generation Zero's position is that the government definitely needs to step up on actually honouring and upholding te tiriti o waitangi, that it's not okay anymore just to have a provision in a piece of legislation saying, well, honour the principles of the treaty,
yeah,
that you do need to work in partnership and collaborate, not just consult, but collaborate with iwi and hapu on what is going on around us. And, yeah, there are significant concerns on Generation Zero's behalf that we are going to breach the Treaty of Waitangi with this piece of legislation, and that projects are going to be put through against iwi wishes, and that there are no real appeal rights apart from on points of law for them, and that's quite concerning to us.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Jen Cotum of Generation Zero. Really interesting things there. I'm going to keep covering this issue because it does sound like we need to have our guard up and stop this continuing if it does, as everyone touched on, go against wishes, of course, by iwi and hapu. We'll be back after these messages.
Discover the diversity of science at the Royal Photographic Society Science Photographer of the Year exhibition on now at MOTAT. For the first time outside of London, 47 intriguing images of science in action. Entry included with general admission. Go to motat.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The June playlist features tracks from Kate NV, Mads Harrop, Chai, Serpent With Feet and more. Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
How good did that this month's instalment of the BFM Spotify playlist sound? Woohoo! Yes, it is time for Neighbourhood Watch. We're hearing from Zoe Canatus again. We might have to jump straight into it and hopefully not fade out because we're running out of time. Let's just get straight into it, shall we? What is branch stacking and why is it so common across Australia's political parties?
It is essentially when you allocate members to your party in very dodgy ways. For example, using false information, signing up people without their consent, paying membership fees for members who aren't even aware that they are members of the party, using dead people's information.
What?
An array of really dodgy things. And what it means is that your party has, or your faction has, a certain amount of members, and that when it comes to decision making, that means that all these quote members are going to vote for the decisions that you want because they're your voters, they're you. It's really quite dodgy, but isn't actually illegal here in Australia, but very frowned upon, obviously. And both parties do have ways of dealing with branch stacking, for example, penalties. And in what we've seen the past week, The Age and 60 Minutes here have investigated a huge branch stacking scandal into the Victorian Labor Party. And this was, it all came down to someone called Adam Smirik. He is at the center of this scandal. He has been fired now, but he was branch stacking very badly within the Labour Party, within his little bubble. And besides him, also two other members now have resigned following this scandal being revealed. But to be fair, the Labour Party, the Victoria Premier especially, and the Federal Labour Party leader, Anthony Albanese, have come out very quickly and very strongly. You know, they didn't even say, let's do an investigation as well. It was just like, no, you're out. And have fired this gentleman. But in saying that, it does prove a bit of a cultural issue within the Labour Party, especially if you do have, if you do see any of the highlight reels from this investigation from The Age. Simeric says some really awful things like, oh, yeah, let's get a bunch of young Labour members, all these effing gay kids just, like, don't even know what they're doing. Just really weird things. Labour is obviously the kind of more centre-left leaning party in Australia. And it does really reveal this kind of awful culture within political parties and has unfortunately given the coalition, so the Liberal Party, a bit of a poking stick as well. For at Labour, which really do need a strong opposition to keep the Liberal Party in check, you know?
Of course.
Guess I would be saying that if the Labour Party was in power too. And it just feels, yeah, this scandal is, and it's not to say that the Liberal Party is perfect either, but like any, we've spoken in the past about the sports rot scandal as well, and it's, yeah, it just shows a lot of the culture within the Australian political parties. And branch stacking is, it's interesting. I've only really learned about it through this scandal, to be fair, but it is quite common within the political party's history.
I wonder, does it seem like there'll be any push to make the practice illegal as opposed to turning it into a kind of finger-pointing conversation?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I feel like there needs to be some sort of change, especially at a federal level, because as I mentioned, at the moment there's only really penalties or punishments in place within the constitutions of these of political parties. But, you know, I think there should be a conversation about how this needs to be made illegal, because giving false information to the
Electoral Commission?
Yeah, because it is illegal to give false voting information to the commissioner. So I don't quite understand why this is sort of slipped through the cracks.
And,
you know, being able to pay memberships for people who don't even really know that they're a party member, or giving false information to, you know, it's inherently wrong, isn't it? And I feel like this is what the Labour Party leaders and even the Liberals are saying, you know, this is wrong. I just don't understand why it isn't a bit more set in stone for how wrong it really is.
Scott Morrison had to apologise and acknowledge the existence of indentured labour in Australia's history after denying the existence of slavery. I noticed that one of the things that he said at the time in his apology was that he wouldn't get involved in the, quote, history wars. What does he mean?
What does he mean? That's such a good point. So, yeah, he initially denied slavery within Australia, and this was because on his backtrack he did say that he was actually just referring to the fact that the state of New South Wales, when it was first, when white people first invaded and then made New South Wales, there was a sort of law that there would be no slavery. And he was just talking about that one time when the invasion first happened. And then obviously there was slavery in Australia's recent history. What he means by history wars is, I guess there's two rhetorics, unfortunately. One is that Captain Cook came and found Australia We went over and, oh, we were in jail for Britain. Oh, we're convicts. Like, yeah. And then we founded Australia and da-da-da. And then the flip side is obviously white people invaded Australia, so-called Australia, and there was genocide of Aboriginal people, and it was absolutely horrific. And that, I think maybe that's what he means by history wars, that there always does feel like there's two histories being spoken about here in Australia. And maybe it feels like they are battling against each other somewhat, because I guess in school and older generations would have been taught the Captain Cook narrative. And then it feels like, especially now, but it feels like there has been a push for a very long time that Australia should really start to be understanding and acknowledging and accepting a really vile history of invasion and colonisation.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire. Sorry to have to fade out while Zoe was making some good points, but it is time for The 1-4 with Sigrid. It's actually my favourite show on BFM, so I never want to encroach into that hour.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.